Okay, good evening. This week we find ourselves in Parshat Shoftim, so we will pick one mitzvah. The relief, one mitzvah that has a few different components, gets counted as a few different mitzvahs. But mitzvah that is untimely in a certain way, because here in the United States and in Medinat Israel, we do not have a monarchy. But on the other hand, there are qualities that are required of a king that perhaps are instructive of what we might expect of one of our own leaders. So it's a little bit of a challenge to relate to the mitzvah, but it's interesting for a little bit of political theory, perhaps. Let's explore. So in Sefer Dvarim, in Parshat Shoftim, tells us, when you come to land that Hashem has given you, and then you inhabit it, and you've taken possession, and then you've inhabited it, you settled it. I'm going to set a king over me, like all the nations around me. Okay, so that's how this begins. So when you are at that stage, the Torah says, "Som tasim alecha melech," you shall place a king, shall appoint a king for yourself. Asher yivchar Hashem lokecha bo, from which Hashem will, Hashem will choose this person, one chosen by Hashem. Mikerev achecha tasim alecha melech, lo tuchal tet alecha ish nachrim, asher lo achicha hu. So it has to be somebody who is from among your own people. It can't be somebody who's a foreigner. Okay, so it has to be somebody Jewish, let's say. Okay, Rakol Yarbelu Susim. However, such a person should not have too many horses. V'lo yashiv ta'am Mitzrayim v'leman harbotus. And you shouldn't bring the nation back to Egypt in order to acquire more horses. V'ashem amar lachan v'tosiv v'lashu b'der chazeh. Because Shem told you not to go down this path the more. Additional requirement is v'lo yarbelu nashim. Shouldn't have too many wives. This is before polygamy was banned. V'lo yasur levavo, and then his heart won't be turned in the wrong path. V'chesed zahav lo yarbelu me'od. Shouldn't have an excess of silver and gold. And when he sits on the throne, the Chatav Lod Mishneh Torah Zot, he must have a copy of this teaching that is written for him. I'll say from Milfnei Kohanim Levim, on a scroll by the Levim and the Kohanim. Okay, so he has to have his own Sefer Torah. And he should have it. He should read it all the time. In order to learn to fear Hashem, so in order to keep the words of Torah and to keep these statutes. Okay, why is that important? So then he won't act haughtily towards his brothers. And Hashem, and then he won't fear from the commandments right or left. In order that he will live a long life, and his descendants will also have the throne for a long period of time. So that was a psukim in Dvarim. So when you come to, in summary, you come to Eretz Yisrael, you decide you want to have a king, so you should appoint a king. But there's still limitations. Not too many horses, not too many wives, not too much money. The person has to write a sefer Torah. And this is all sort of couched in moral terms, moral language. We're concerned about the behaviors and the attitudes of this person. Okay, so when one looks at these psukim, there's two different ways you can look at it. On the one hand, it sounds like it's when you come to Eretz Yisrael and only when you say, I would like to appoint a king, that you should appoint a king. On the other hand, in the second pasuk, when it says, Som tasim alecha melech, so that sounds like a command. You shall appoint a king. So this is a discussion that begins with the Tanaim, the early sages, and it continues on a bit. So in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, it quotes Rabbi Nehorai, who said that Lo Nemar Parsha Zo Ela Keneged Tara Mutan, that this passage was only said in response to the Jewish people's complaints. That when you complain, if you will end up complaining that I want a king, so here's what you do. But from this, it doesn't sound like it's a very positive thing, something that Hashem necessarily wants. It's only something to do if the complaint comes up. And then Rabbi Eliezer says, "Skenim shvedor kehogin shalu." The elders in the generation asked appropriately to have a king. But meaning the elders, it was appropriate for them when they asked for a king. And this is talking about in the days of Shmuel, which we'll get to. But the common folk kind of messed it up because they added that we want to judge like all the nations around us. Okay, so we have two here opinions that seem to have a negative view of the monarchy. On the other hand, Rabbi Yossi says, Shalosh mitzvot nitzavu Yisrael b'chnisatan la'aretz. There are three mitzvot that B'nai Yisrael were commanded to do when they entered the land, and one of them is l'hamid l'ham melech. One is to appoint a king. So according to Rabbi Yossi, this was a proper thing to do upon entering Eretz Yisrael. Okay, and one thing to note here is that a proof for this idea of there being a throne. And so in the, with regard to the Battle of the Lake, Amalek, the pasuk says, "Ki yad al kes ka mechama l'shem Amalek," the hand upon the throne of the Lord. The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. So, at first you have a king, and then you go to war. Right, because there's no throne without a king, so therefore there's no war without a king. And it calls it case cuts. It's the throne of the Lord, which means that the king is somehow representing Hashem. So that also adds to the positive element of it. So this is a dispute among the Tanaim. Is this a mitzvah or not? And what's with the negative versus the positive? How could such a passage in the Torah, how could such a potential mitzvah spark such controversy? Is it good? Is it required or is it horrible? It's a very wide range of possibilities. So the Sefer HaChinuch comments that it's a mitzvah to appoint a king. He counts this as the 497th mitzvah, going in order of the Torah itself. It says, we have to win upon ourselves a king based on this pasuk, Sama Tasim Allah HaMelech. It's positive commandment. Sefer HaChinuch says it's a mitzvah. And why is it a mitzvah? So elsewhere, the Sefer HaChinuch comments that when you think about it, people usually don't agree. People aren't single-minded. Okay, so he says, L'fishi yivshar l'shub ne'adam yiblish yesu achami ne'ahem rosh al acherim. Somebody has to be in charge. Somebody has to be the king who's going to lay down the laws, because people tend to disagree. Nobody agrees. What's going to happen? It's going to be total chaos, and it's going to be, he said it's going to be idleness, cessation of actions. Like everyone's going to always, be on the street fighting it out, right? Instead of there being a productive society, everyone's going to be arguing about. Everyone has two Jews, three opinions. So you have a population of millions of people. So everyone is constantly giving their opinions, and that can't work. So therefore, you have to have one person. Whether it is good or bad, whether that person's opinion is good or bad, at least that way, society will be productive, and it'll prevent controversy. So Sefer HaChinuch says that appointing king is a positive mitzvah. And so does the Rambam. The Rambam says that the 173rd positive commandment is to appoint a king. He says, "Alimnot alinu melech b'Yisrael." There's a positive command to appoint ourselves a Jewish king. So, some one might understand from this that really, it's not that there's a positive mitzvah to appoint a king, but it's that the king that's appointed has to be Jewish. It has to be somebody from Am Yisrael. But when you look at the Mishneh Torah, it does seem like that he counts the mitzvah to appoint a king as the mitzvah to appoint a king. It's something that is obligatory in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, and he says that as long as whatever he says doesn't contradict the Torah, you have to listen. It's like the Sefer HaChinuch, don't want anarchy. Somebody's going to be in charge. They lay down the laws, so and whatever they say goes, as long as it doesn't contradict the Torah. Okay, so two people who tallied up the mitzvahs counted as a positive mitzvah to do this. However, granted, these are not in terms of those who created lists of the number of this of the 613 mitzvahs, and it's not even necessarily psak halacha, but Ibn Ezra in his commentary on the Chumash understands that appointing a king is optional. It's a shoot. It's something that you can do if you want. Right? That seems to make sense from the way the pasuk says. You shall when you come to Eretz Yisrael, and you say, you know, would like to have a king, so then you can appoint a king. That's the way to read it. Okay. Rav Hirsch, Rav Shimshon Frau Hirsch. It'd be interesting to look to see, you know, how context perhaps maybe influenced some of the comments about kings. We'll see that with the Abarbanel it did. Rav Shimshon Frau Hirsch lived in Germany, in a relatively modern period. And he said that it actually depends. Is it a mitzvah to appoint a king? It depends whether there's a need for it. Because if there's no need for it, then don't do it. But there could be potential need. What would be the potential need? So, and this is how he understands the idea that I want to appoint a king like all the other nations, right? It would seem like it's, we have a prohibition of chukot ha'goyim, that we're not supposed to imitate what the other nations do, especially in the religious realm. So it seems like a blatant violation of that. And yet he's saying, you're not doing it because the other nations are doing it and you want to be like them. But the reason why other nations have a king, because you need to consolidate resources and you need to have some sort of direction. Okay, so Rav Hirsch says that the potential need that would warrant appointing a king is that if that's the only way that everything is going to be, gathered and used as a proper resources, and that everything is going to be managed appropriately, so then you appoint a king. And this comes up, whether one believes in more limited government or more expanded government. There definitely is a sense, whether it's on the city level, the state level, the federal level, that certain things definitely, there needs to be a coordinated national effort in certain situations. Otherwise, it's imbalanced. Not everybody has what they need, especially when it's in the interest of the public. So that's what Rav Hirsch is advocating. And the Nesiv in Hamadavar says something that's perhaps even more to the modern sensibility, that appointing a king, he says, is permission. It's a matter of permission. It's optional. It's not mandatory. But it's saying that, if you want to, you could. And he says that there are some states where you need to have a king, and if you didn't have a king, it would be completely chaos, because that's like having a captain without a ship. And yet, there are some states, there's some countries, mishum dehanhagat amanita mishtana, even ha'ek al-pi dat melucha al-pi dat ha'aman v'nivcharim. Is it a kingdom or is it a democracy? And there are some states where you need to have a king, because otherwise you have a, you know, it's like you have a ship without a captain. And there are other states where they can't possibly tolerate the idea of having a king. Instead of writing this, probably knowing full well of the United States, and I don't even know what else that in his time was a democracy, but some, you know, in some places it makes sense to have a king. In some places, it totally doesn't work. So, if let's say in Eretz Yisrael, it was desirable to have a king, so then that's the right thing to do. You have permission to do it. But if it's the desire of the people to create sort of a republic, then they have permission to do so. So nobody so far has really said that it's entirely negative to have a king, right? In terms of past the Gemara, the Sefer HaMitzvos and the different Mefarshim that we've seen so far all seem to say that having a king is either a mitzvah or it's something that it's optional, something that's allowed, depending on either circumstances, what the people want, what's necessary in the time. Now, there is a sentiment in Tanakh, however, that having a king was not something that was desirable. So we first see this in Sefer Shoftim with Gidon, who is an important leader who brought Bnei Israel to victory. So they said to him, Shol Banu, you shall rule over us. And he said to them, Lom Shol, I'm not going to rule over you. Lom Shol Bnei Bachem, my children aren't going to rule over you either. Hashem Yom Shol Bachem. However, Hashem's going to rule over you. So this gets at a little bit of the tension that if, and Rosh Hashanah is coming up quite shortly, and just I guess on the English calendar, it's a month for today. So whether or not we live, whether our human government is democracy, oligarchy, monarchy, whatever it is, if Hashem created the world and Hashem controls it, then it's a monarchy, and Hashem is the true ruler. And especially if we choose to be his nation, so in some ways, Hashem is Malkeinu. Hashem is our king. And that is who's in charge. That is who's in charge. If everyone follows his rules, all will be okay. And getting in, you know, inviting in a human being to fill that role is dangerous. And likewise, we see some ambivalence in Sefer Shmuel. Okay, this one's a little more familiar. That Shmuel had sons who did not follow his way in life. They were not necessarily amazing. And the people came in to him and said, you know, you're getting older. We want to have a king like all the other nations. And Shmuel was very upset about this. Shmuel was upset about this, and he dove into Hashem. And Hashem said, listen to them. And he says, it's not you that they reject, but it's me that they reject. Right? So Gideon's concern before was that people would sort of reject Hashem by having a human ruler. And that's what ultimately came to be, as presented here, that Hashem was supposed to be the king. They rejected Hashem. They want a king. That's not necessary. That's not something for Shmuel to feel bad about. That's just how the people are. And Hashem says, this is the way it's been this whole time. So listen to them, appoint a king, and that's what is going to happen. So why was Shmuel upset about it? So it could be that Shmuel was upset about appointing a king, either because he took it personally, because he thought that, as the pasuk seems to imply, that, that maybe he didn't do a good job as a reflection on him. But you know, if you look at the mitzvah to appoint a king as an actual mitzvah, that is something you're obligated to do, then it seems like Shmuel shouldn't have any complaints. If it's something that's permission, maybe he does have the right to complain. Rambam in Hilchot Melachim says that, you know, given that appointing a king is a mitzvah, So why did why did Shmuel get upset? And why did Kosh Baruch Hu even have some pushback about it? Because they made a request due to complaint and resentment, not to fulfill a mitzvah, but only because they were rejecting Shmuel and his sons and the general premise of having a more spiritual leader like a prophet. So according to Rambam, Shmuel's being upset about appointing king is it's a mitzvah, but it was done for the wrong reasons. Okay, we can relate to the idea that somebody can do a mitzvah and do it for the wrong reasons. So that's perhaps what was going on with B'nai Israel. But Yabar Benel points out a problem. Yabar Benel is the most forceful, again, saying that that appointing king is a mitzvah. Because, first of all, if appointing king was a mitzvah, then why are we waiting until Shmuel? They were in Eretz Yisrael for much longer than that. So they shouldn't have waited for Shmuel to appoint a king. They apparently should have done it earlier, right? When they, either right before they conquered the land, maybe there's a way to read it that you do it after you conquer the land. But at the very least, if it's truly a mitzvah, then that means that B'nai Israel were violating this mitzvah if they were supposed to have already done it. So Rabbi Nel does not think that appointing a king is a mitzvah. It is at best reshut. And Rabbi Nel thinks that's actually a negative thing. It's a negative thing to have a king. So one thing we've already mentioned perhaps is that is the approach of Gidon that having a king sort of compromises one's relationship to God. That if you view a human as a king, they don't view Hashem as your boss. But he points out a couple of things. Number one, wouldn't it be better if people rotated? And then when people are accountable to each other, people can choose you won't get carried away. But there's accountability. And number two, we have the principle of Malacha Yachid V'Rab and Malacha Kirabim. We have the minority, the majority. The halacha is like the majority. So wouldn't it be better to follow the will of the majority of the people than to have one person who can force people to act by their whim? So those are two arguments, at least, that are Rabbanel, and he has more. Two arguments that Rabbanel has against appointing a king. He also goes on to say that, first of all, B'nai Israel were saved by God. They fight for God. You don't need a king to lead you out to battle. That's what Hashem's for. Hashem is our king. Hashem is our leader. And he points out that most of the kings, when you look back at the rest of Tanakh, most of the kings ended up being pretty bad. The Shoftim and the Nevi'im, some were better than others, but most of them were pretty good. But the kings, most of them, the kings among Israel were pretty bad. And in Yehuda also, most of them were not great. Some of them were completely righteous. Some were better than others. But some were horrible. So we have proof from Tanakh that having a king didn't exactly work out. So therefore, Rabbi Nel says, this is not a mitzvah at all, but Hashem was merely, or Moshe was explaining what would happen in the future. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu anticipated that eventually people are going to ask for a king because he knows how people work. He understands sociology, and when other nations around you have a king, so you want a king also. So Hashem understood how that works. So this parsha is just setting up the future that eventually there will become a point where you want to appoint a king. And here's how you do it. And here are the things that you can't do. Here are the things that you can't do, right? So we saw in the Pesukim that can't have too many wives, can't have too many horses, not too much money. So that's what Parshat Melech is for. It's a matter of a permission. And if you do it, here's how, here are the guidelines for the king. But appointing a king according to the Bar Menel is not a mitzvah, and he doesn't view it at all as a desirable form of government. And when you look through the rest of his writings, that's reflected in what he really thought about his political situation, that he thought that republics were better than monarchies. Fine. So one of the requirements, as we said, before that, just to summarize, so a bit of machloket about whether appointing king is a mitzvah or not. The Gemara itself, there's a machloket between that's recorded between a couple of different of the earlier sages of the Tanaim. And among our Rishonim as well, whether in their law codes or in their commentaries on the Torah. So you have a little bit of original opinions about whether it is the required or a permission, or even in the case of Bar Menel, it's optional and really not recommended. So let's just say one does appoint a king. Ramban said, the Torah says that you're not supposed to have too many horses. So Rashi explains that prohibition said you're not supposed to have the horses because you're not supposed to go back to Egypt, period. Ramban says that doesn't make sense to me because the Yerushalmi says that you are allowed to go back for commerce and trade and the like. So if you're getting horses from Egypt and it's just a matter of commerce, like you're not hanging out there, you're not living there long term, but you're just going to buy the horses and coming back, so that should be completely permitted. So therefore, Ramban says, the reason for the prohibition of having too many horses is that even when it's permitted for you to have too many horses, you shouldn't place your trust in your horses, and you shouldn't count how many horses, or for that matter, how many airplanes and tanks you have, but your trust is supposed to be in Hashem. Very important and very powerful that not having too many horses, not for here to determine what that limit is, but it ultimately is not about, it says in Sakhari, lo b'chayv lo b'koach kim b'ruchi, that at the end of the day, you need very practical methods in order to engage in war, and you need to have the tools, without the tools, but it's not ultimately about them. But you're supposed to remember that a king is an emissary of Hashem, and Hashem's the one who guides. Okay? And Ramban goes on to explain that the reason for this mitzvah, not having too many horses, is because the Egyptians and Canaanim were corrupt, were not supposed to be like them. So that also, it almost sheds more light on the general approach of having a king than about having too many horses. Okay, there is a concern, obviously, again here, there's a concern about going back to Egypt and settling there permanently in order to groom horses. So that's not allowed. But that's not what this is about. That's not the prohibition of not having horses is to make sure that you place your trust in Hashem. But more broadly speaking, in general, when it comes to the mitzvah related to a king, so yeah, we might want to have a king like other nations, and we'll see that there's, I think we saw from Rafersh that there's a reason for that other nations have a king because that makes sense in order to make sure that there's a coordination and consolidation resources. So that might be legitimate, but if a king is going to engage in immoral behaviors the way other monarchs do, then that's not how one should be like other nations. That is very problematic. Rabbeinu Bachaye, explaining why you can't have too many horses, not just about the trusting Hashem in war, but it's also about what are your priorities. Are my priorities to have too many horses, and for that matter, to have lots of wives and money, and I'm just focusing on the hedonism? So he says, Yesh malachim yosin me'ila dvar me'ikar. Some of these things are what the essence are. Being king is about having all the perks, and it's about having whatever I want. But Melchizedek, Yechzeb Rubuim. A Jewish king needs to have some of these, but that's not their focus. Their focus is not on accumulating wealth and property, but they're supposed to be guided by Torah and by fear of heaven, and that's their job. So if they get to a certain point where they say, I have what I need, I have enough money, I have enough horses, so leave it at that. And now my job is to lead the people with a proper spiritual manner. And that's not just a, you know, that's not just, you know, a fluffy idea, but can really get into the essence of the way somebody behaves as a ruler and the way they carry themselves. That if somebody's idea of being a ruler is about the power and the indulgence and the like, so that, you know, that's one way to do it. But the Torah believes that even when one chooses to have a king, and maybe it's right and important to give that person a lot of power because that's ultimately what's going to keep everything in order, but being too focused on materialism, even for a king, is problematic and will lead them astray. It's not just that they're not going to be firm, but they're also going to get way out of hand, and that's going to lead to their political and spiritual corruption. Okay, so how much money can one have? So Rabbeinu Bechai says, look, king obviously needs to accumulate a lot of wealth because they're responsible for running government. So they have to pay their soldiers. They have to, you know, they have to distribute resources. They have to pay servants. And there's a lot that a king has to take care of. The idea is that whatever they're collecting for the greater good. But he says, in Rosha Lasso Bimena Otar Skula. You can't just do it to have a lot of money in the bank and to have a lot of wealth. That's not appropriate. That's not what a king does. The king should collect money in order to make sure that the needs of the state are taken care of, but it's not for them. And that's why you can't have too many horses. That's why not too much money, because otherwise you're just chasing after money. And then again, you're totally veering from Hashem. You're not thinking about Hashem, but you're thinking about me and my wealth. And it matters, because if everything's about, you know, my own wealth and material collection, then I'm focused on the ego. And if my ego clashes with what Hashem wants, my ego is going to win out. And that is what we're worried about. Rav Hirsch points out, when it comes to money, and gold and silver, so it says that you shouldn't have an excess. It says, v'chesvizav lo yirba lo me'od, shouldn't have too much of it. With horses and without too many wives, it just says, you know, shouldn't have too much, but it doesn't say me'od. It doesn't say, you know, it doesn't emphasize this idea of excess. So he says, a king has more needs and more reason to collect money than an average person. He needs them in order to, you know, ensure first the independence of his position, that he needs to have some sort of leverage, and also to fulfill his role. But pilato shel melech l'kidum shloma haruchani v'kufani shel ha'am. His job is to ensure the spiritual and material welfare of the people who need him. So he says, so therefore it says, lo yibre lo me'od, don't have too much, because he needs some. And it shouldn't be yotam min hadrusha, shouldn't be more than that. Ahe atzla ha'ashir, shouldn't be passion for riches, because then again, it's corruption, it's taking money for unnecessary purposes. You have to be grounded in what's necessary, what's proper. And maybe as a king, you do deserve to have more than others, but you can't let it get to excess. Okay. So these are, you know, fairly obvious concerns that that a person who is obsessing with their military glory and their material glory is going to totally lose sight of their mission. The Torah warns against that. And part of the antidote to that is that the Torah says that a king needs to write their own Sefer Torah. So what's that about? So Rav Hirsch actually has a very interesting idea that it's not just about you're knowing the mitzvahs, but a person needs to know the both the historical and the instructive contents of the Torah. Why does the king need to know the historical aspects? Because you need to understand, you know, what's the nation's history, what's its destiny, what's it about? Okay, when people learn, I like learning American history because it gives me appreciation for, you know, what this country stands for and what its ideals are, and you know why it was founded, and the big and bold ideas it put forth that made our nation, you know, work as well and be sort of a promising society the way it has generally been for the past 244 years, if I got 254 years, if I got that right. So very interesting. King needs to understand, you know, if you just get up there and you're just about rule and you're ruling, so again, you lose sight of your mission. You don't really know why you're doing what you're doing, and you're going to make bad decisions. But if you understand, you know, who are my people and what are we about? What's our mission statement? So then you'll do this more properly. You'll understand it clearly. And then he says, you shall work constantly towards their full realization. So that's the purpose of a Sefer Torah, that you can't be a good king without understanding, you know, what Am Yisrael is about. If you want to rule Am Yisrael, you need to understand Torah Yisrael, and you need to implement that. And I think that's a very important thing to keep in mind for any political leader, that when you make decisions for this people, so you need to understand, you know, what are its ideals, what's its history, what have we fought for, who are we, and then that can inform your decisions. But even on a more basic level, you know, obviously it's interesting because it says the pasuk says the king needs to write the Ketavot Mishneh HaTorah Hazot. So Sefer Dvarim is often referred to as Mishneh Torah. So the special emphasis perhaps on Sefer Dvarim, I might argue, is because Sefer Dvarim, more than any other book in Tanakh, is a Moser Sefer. That especially in the earlier Parshiot, it's a little bit lighter on the actual mitzvot and very heavy on the lofty ideals and values of fearing Hashem and loving Hashem. And a king needs to have that also. So yeah, you need to, you know, I like what Rav Hirsch says about understanding the historical thing. I think it's a brilliant point. We also stipulate the fact that just plain and simple, a king who is a God-fearing person understands that, you know, you might think that I'm in charge of everything and everybody, but no, I'm still answerable to a Kodesh Baruch Hu, that I don't get to do whatever I want. I don't get to treat people the way I want, but with all of my power, there's still some sort of a check and balance, and that's with HaKadosh Baruch. But that's the importance of the Sefer Torah. The Malbim points out that obviously the king is bound by following halacha. There's a concern that's brought in the next pasuk that a king's going to be haughty over other people. So when it comes to Torah mitzvot, a king's supposed to be equal to other Jews. And again, that's a very powerful idea, that there is a check and balance, that not in every single way a king gets to be lofty and important, but they're still a humble servant of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But Malbim knows, it is true that in other contexts, yes, a king is supposed to, you know, be elevated above other people because they have a job to do. They have to create the rules. They even have the right to intrude. They can pave a path wherever they want. They have that right to intrude. So as long as the king's not veering from the laws of the Torah and the spirit of the Torah, so yes, they do have certain privileges that put them above everybody else. But when it comes to things right to Yirat Shemayim, he's an equal like everybody else. He's also supposed to be God-fearing. Okay? The Ramban notes that the last pasuk is that a person's heart should become haughty before above, you know, shouldn't be too elevated above other people. So it's interesting because what this is basically saying, Ramban says, is that what's intended here is the prohibition of arrogance. Not be arrogant. And it's interesting that it's pointing that out with the king, because that's true with the king, that's certainly true of everybody else. Right? Or if you were to look at it in the reverse, if Gaiva is bad for everybody, all the more so it's bad for the king. He says, "Keep your oily from manly gadel as he readily yod levavosh shafel kechol chavaktani mimenu." He also needs to have a little bit of humility. Even a king, when it comes to a king, too much of an ego, too much haughtiness, too much self-centeredness is despicable, undesirable before Hashem. Okay, so this continues on with the theme of writing Sefer Torah, of not having too many riches, that while the king is certain is privy to certain privileges and powers, but if it totally gets to his head, he's going to do the wrong thing. And again, he's an Eved Hashem, and Hashem doesn't like anybody to be haughty. Even a king does not have that right. The Barbanel points out that a king is even more susceptible to that, obviously, right? That's eventually at some point in this year is going to have to quote the idea that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So if somebody has absolute power, they're definitely there's a reason to be concerned about their being too haughty. So even he in some areas has to exercise self-control, can't be too haughty, very bad mida even for a king. And the Rambam points out in Hilchot Malachim that this idea of being a Yirei Hashem, of being God-fearing, is something that he says, if a person doesn't have Yirat Shemayim, even if they're smart, they can't be a leader among the Jewish people, which is very, I think, important for us to think about. That we can think of certain people who've done brilliant things, they have brilliant politics, but if they're not fundamentally a good person, if they're corrupt, then they totally miss the mark. And certainly when it comes to what Judaism's view on leadership is, no amount of political savviness or even competency or doing a good job excuses one from casting off the yoke of heaven, because then, as you know, as Barmanel said, inevitably it's going to cause somebody to get to corruption. And this, in fact, happened to Shlomo HaMelech. I'm just going to skip to this point here, that Rabbi Yitzchak says that in general, the Torah didn't reveal the reasons for the commandments, because if you know the reasons, then it only sets you up to fail. Who is example of Shlomo HaMelech? Shlomo HaMelech had too many wives, had too many horses, and he said, "I know the reason why I'm not supposed to have too many. It's because then I'll be led astray, but I won't be led astray." And then turns out he was led astray because he's human and he was a king, and that was guaranteed to happen. So for whatever reasons, the Torah did have to reveal the reasons here, but it shows how even somebody as great as Shlomo HaMelech, and certainly anybody else, can be susceptible to immoral behavior when it gets too much to your head. So is having a king, is having a monarchy, is it good, is it bad? So we've seen different opinions, and you know, some definitely thought that the risks, that one's going to forget Hashem, that one's going to be corrupted. And you can even see, you know, even with the Torah's permission to have a king, or even the mitzvah to have a king, it is very, very wary of what a king can do. And it sets very clear standards for making sure that whatever powers you have, that you don't forget that a Yirei Shamayim. So this is a matter of debate. And Rabbi Zach says that, you know, there's a little bit of balance here, that on the one hand, the ideal society, as the Torah conceives it, is really one in which nobody rules or exercises power over anybody else other than God himself. And some demonstrated through Gidon and Shmuel that it's really better if everybody is just God-fearing and lets the Torah be our ruler in some respect. And Rabbi Sachs points out that's really what Shabbos is about. At Shabbos, I'm not allowed to force anybody else. I can't, you know, force a slave, or you're technically not supposed to even employ anybody on Shabbos. You're not supposed to have any work done on your behalf. But it shows that we don't rule over anybody. However, one thing we haven't discussed yet, but in as much as Sefer Shoftim presents a view that is concerned about Gidon feeling like, you know, really Hashem should be in charge of me. On the other hand, in Sefer Shoftim, there was a cycle where there was no king, and Isha Isha Bein Avyasa, that people did whatever was right in their eyes. So yes, maybe in an ideal world, it would be better if we don't rule over each other. And it's obvious, because we don't make good decisions for each other and we abuse other people. But on the other hand, without that, then you have anarchy and everybody does what they feel like. And that also leads to a very perverse result. So he goes on to say, the Torah devotes extraordinary attention to the non-political aspects of society formation and maintenance. It speaks of education, stuck on the duty to give part of the nation's produce to the poor. It talks of virtues and self-restraints. So he says that's very different than other societies, because on the one hand, you might need a government in order to make sure that there is some, you know, law and order. But in addition to having a sort of social contract, which is what creates a state and relationship between people and the rulers, we have a social covenant. And that's really what society is based on, is that really if we educate people to be good citizens, then that's the best way to go. And in theory, that's how democracy is supposed to work best, that with proper education, proper values, so the people are able to choose how they want to be ruled because they have this social covenant. So that's what he believes the Torah is about. It sees more clearly than any other system known to me that politics, principal use of power, is only part and a relatively small part of what creates a gracious society dedicated to the common good. So I don't want to extrapolate too far. We're obviously at a point where we're thinking about who our next leader is going to be, and this is constant. You know, even though Israel just has just elected a new government, still constant discussion. You know, this is what the Torah expects of the Jewish people, not necessarily what it expects of other nations. And at the same time, I think that when we think about what these values are, when we look at the Parshat HaMelech, we understand what the different concerns are, then we learn valuable lessons of hopefully what we aspire to have in a leader, no matter what we want. That on the one hand, we want somebody who can rule with competency and to make sure that the needs of society are fulfilled. And at the same time, that such a person is decent and humble. And even if they have certain perks by necessity of what they do, that they don't abuse those and make sure that whatever they're doing is for the good of the people. And if they're a religious person, certainly in order to serve Hashem, not in order to serve their inflated egos.